Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero will join project developers later today to announce a new proposal for redeveloping portions of the historic Michigan School for the Blind campus in Lansing. That announcement will be made at the Neighborhood Empowerment Center on the east side of the MSB campus. That is at 600 West Maple in Lansing. Bob Johnson of the city's Planning and Neighborhood Development Director will also be there, apparently also with the developers. We shall see what they have in mind. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State here on WKAR. Last month, Governor Rick Snyder signed into law a bill that's been generating vigorous discussion ever since. Among other things, the measure bans local governments and school districts from spending public dollars on advertisement-style communication about bond and millage proposals in the 60 days prior to a vote. Supporters say those entities have gone beyond a just-the-facts approach and too often veer into advocacy. Some opponents have blasted the bill as a gag order that stops them from informing voters about the measures that voters will decide. To learn more, we welcome Chris Wygent, Executive Director of the Michigan Association of School Administrators. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also, we want to welcome back Superintendent of the Lansing School District, Yvonne Kamal Kanul. Good to see you.
Good morning, Mark.
We want to point out that if you have a question for our guests, feel free to tweet us at KAR Current State or email us currentstate@wkar.org. A couple of things before we get started. This new law covers a lot of ground, more ground than we will cover today. We're going to focus on the communication ban today, and I'm hoping we can get into the other features of the law in the coming days and maybe in part during this segment here today. Secondly, we'll mention that last Thursday, a follow-up measure aimed at refining or clarifying this measure was submitted by State Rep Lisa Postumus Lyons, who played a central role in the bill that was signed into law by Governor Snyder just before Christmas. We'll get into that a little bit here shortly. First, let's talk about what the governor signed just before Christmas. Critics have referred to this measure as a gag order. Chris Wygent, do you feel that way? Is this a gag order?
We certainly feel that way, Mark. This is a gag order that 60 days before a very important election to the voters, whether it's millage, whether it's consolidation of districts, whatever it might be, the school district cannot and is prohibited from providing factual information to the taxpayers in the community. We think that's very inappropriate. We want to be all about transparency. We want to make sure voters know the facts before they go to the polls. You're a voter in a community, a school district. You would want to know up to 60 days before what you're voting on. This law prohibits us from providing that factual information.
Yvonne Kamal Kanul, what about you? A gag order?
It does feel that way, Mark. I believe that it limits access for the public to important information that will help them make an informed decision once they get to the polls.
Writing on MLive, in response to this kind of criticism, Representative Postumus Lyons wrote that it's not a gag order, and I'll quote here, "It clearly doesn't infringe upon First Amendment rights of elected or appointed officials to share their personal positions on ballot questions, and it most certainly doesn't prevent them from answering residents' questions in any setting," unquote. She seems to be saying that you as individuals are not barred from talking about this. Are you disputing that,
well,
Yvonne?
I don't know that I would dispute it, but I would say that as a superintendent of a school district, large school district, I believe that my position as superintendent is a 24/7 proposition. And so I'm not sure what the fine line is between my own time and the time on which I am a representative of the Lansing School District. So that would be sort of splitting hairs as far as I'm concerned.
But Chris Wygent, are we agreed that this pertains to advertisement-style mass communications, direct mail efforts, I presume?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between advertising and facts. What we know is that we cannot provide factual information, whether that's sending out flyers, however that might be. And around the state, that's very important for communities to know exactly what they're going to be voting on. So advertising to me leans a little towards advocacy, perhaps, but what we're talking about here are the facts of the situation.
I think a lot of people would agree, though, that line can get very slippery between sometimes you'll open up the Sunday supplement and if the little word advertisement weren't at the top of the page, you wouldn't be sure whether you're looking at, quote, journalism or, quote, advertising, unquote. That line can get very, very hard to determine sometimes.
Mark, would you mind if I address that for a second?
No, by all means.
Because some of the critics of our position have said, you know, for years, school districts have promoted their millage or bond elections with taxpayer dollars. So we did the research. We checked with the Secretary of State's office. And over the last 4 years, only three districts have been fined for doing this type of thing. And so we continue to hear this. We continue to hear this kind of random, yep, school districts are using inappropriate behavior. They're doing these types of things. Three districts after 4 years. So I don't know the problem we're trying to solve here.
In the let's talk about what Michigan school districts are accustomed to doing here. In these 60 days prior to a bond vote, let's say, are Michigan school districts accustomed to sharing this kind of information in this way?
They absolutely are. Whether that's flyers, whether that's on a sign outside of their school district, whether it's a superintendent attending an event, the who, what, when, where, and why, all of the factual information. Districts need to do that. Districts want to be transparent. And again, taxpayers have said, please be open with us about what we're voting for. And that's what school districts do up to 60 days before.
I know that school districts and administrators have been consulting with their attorneys on this. I'd like to hear from both of you.
Yes.
Is the Lansing School District in that in
yes.
that position?
Yes, we certainly, as a matter of fact, the day the letter or the bill was signed by the governor, we contacted our legal representatives to find out what our obligations were and what kind of leeway we had to move forward with our millage issue in May. I would like to say that, you know, we're all very familiar with the information versus advocacy line. And perhaps the legislature isn't as familiar with how we do this in school districts, but we have an information campaign by providing information, as Chris mentioned. We also, citizen groups can come together and advocate for a millage, but that's above and beyond what a district does. So there's a very clear distinction between information and advocacy.
Again, I want to return to this issue, though, this allegation here that districts are guilty periodically of communicating a message designed to generate support for the measure. The irony of this is I'm led to believe there is an existing law that already bans this, but apparently it has been violated, Chris, as you pointed out, some number of times. It appears the legislature, the majority Republican legislature, just felt that this needed more teeth.
Well, and the key word there is felt, because they're certainly not looking at the data that three school districts out of 500 and some districts over a four-year period have been found guilty, if you will, of violating that current law. So I continue to hear felt. I continue to hear we think. I continue to hear there are examples. But I don't see those. And certainly the Secretary of State's office has not seen those as well. So I go back to what problem are we trying to solve here? It just doesn't seem to be relevant.
We're talking with Chris Wygent, Executive Director of the Michigan Association of School Administrators, along with Lansing School District Superintendent Yvonne Kamal Kanul, about the new law Governor Rick Snyder signed just a couple of weeks ago here, that bans local governments and school districts from spending public dollars on advertisement-style communication about bond and millage proposals. That is in the 60 days prior to a vote. Some local governments, Yvonne, have complained that the bill the governor signed could stop them from discussing ballot proposals at televised meetings specifically. Was that a concern of yours? Was that on your radar?
You know, Mark, I think about my colleague and good friend Teresa Weatherall Neal in Grand Rapids, who just passed a bond issue in this past fall. She went to over 119 different community forum sessions to discuss and share information about a very large bond issue. So it's not always possible for everyone to go to 119 the way Teresa did. She did yeoman's work. some of that information needs to be done through televised communication, through radio spots, through flyers. And so there have to be multiple ways in which to communicate with our constituencies. Not all of our constituencies have access to a single way of communicating. You know, in the rural areas, they may not have access to internet. In the urban areas, economically, they may not have access to multiple ways of communicating. So this is particularly difficult time for anyone to be passing this kind of legislation. And I might add, sort of, you know, in the middle of the night.
That is another feature of this measure here that we want to get into here. We'll point out that Representative Postumus Lyons' inner follow-up measure submitted last Thursday addresses the issue of a possible ban of discussion of ballot proposals at televised meetings. Her follow-up measure stipulates that it doesn't impact the discussion of a ballot question during any meeting of a public body. Any reassurance there, Chris Wygen?
No, none at all. Quite frankly, I think that's cosmetic, because as we look at this, the 60-day ban is still in. And until that's removed for our association, we cannot support that change in the legislation. It just seems like for some reason that 60-day ban needs to stay in there. And once again, we find that unacceptable. Hey, could I expand on something that Yvonne said?
Of course.
We represent superintendents in every school district in the state of Michigan. And so while we think about the Lansing or other urban areas, Yvonne mentioned rural, I think about the Upper Peninsula and the communication problems and challenges that they have up there because of their the whole geographic area. And for school superintendents and districts in the Upper Peninsula not to be able to provide information to their voters when communication is already difficult, it just seems to me like that keeps people in the dark. And quite frankly, unlike the legislation that was approved, we're all about transparency, and we want to make sure that the voters see what they're going to be voting on.
Yvonne Kamal-Kanul, you've got a pretty big millage proposal on the calendar here for later 2016, the Pathway Promise.
Yes.
How will this law impact the way you go about communicating about the Pathway Promise?
Well, I will say, first of all, that I want to just appeal to everyone to understand that I have about 100 colleagues who are going for millages in March. And so the gag order is already in effect for them. I will stop talking about the bond campaign and the information with regards to our $120 million Lansing Pathway Promise proposal on March 4th if this legislation is not repealed.
The necessity of a follow-up measure here was mentioned by Governor Snyder when he nonetheless signed the original measure into law. Representative Postumus Lyons didn't lose too much time filing this. And the reason I bring this up is that there was, not for the first time, intense criticism of the process. You've both alluded to this, I think. Much of this bill, Senate Bill 571, wasn't brought up until around 10 p.m. on the last night of the 2015 session. It added a lot of stuff to the bill that reportedly was not discussed in session. No hearings. A lot of legislators didn't know really or didn't understand what they were voting on. Chris Wygent, I assume you're familiar with how the Capitol works after all this time. Is it as bad as critics have labeled it?
I think it's even worse than critics have labeled it. It was a situation where no one knew what was going on. This was not on any formal agenda. We found out about it the next day. There were no hearings. There was no transparency. We have legislators who admitted that they did not read the additional pages and they still voted yes. Yeah, I think that's pretty bad. You know, here we are fighting for the right to be transparent, the right for 60 days within an election to provide facts. And we're fighting a legislature that right now did this in the dark of night. It is very concerning to me that we do hear from the governor about transparency being fair to taxpayers. And quite frankly, this lack of process just was very, very concerning for me, not only as a professional, but also as a citizen.
Has the Lansing School District ever participated in what would arguably could be defined as advertisement-style mass communications?
The Lansing School District has not participated in advertising. It participates in sharing...
Advertising style.
Oh, advertising style.
Again, the line can be squishy. I think that's probably what proponents of this bill
would
say.
Well, a couple years ago, we passed a non-homestead millage renewal, and we were very clear about the information that we shared. And advertising, from the way we understand it, and I think most of us, is that you are advocating for a position on that proposal. And so we do not advocate for a position on a proposal. We share as much information as possible about what the money will do. And I will add that, you know, in the world of declining resources, it's impossible for us to spend our general fund money on improvements of buildings, our facilities, technology, security, things like that. So millage proposals are an important way districts actually are able to get revenue to improve their facilities. So this is a critical juncture for the state of Michigan, I think, and its aspect on education.
We want to thank Lansing School District Superintendent Yvonne Kamal Kanul, also Chris Wygent, Executive Director of the Michigan Association of School Administrators. We are working to line up State Representative Lisa Postumus-Lyons to join us on the program to talk about her follow-up measure and about the original measure as well. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Mark. Yep, thanks,
thank
Chris.
You very much, Mark.
And coming up on Current State, the political fallout from the water crisis in Flint continues to unfold. But for public health experts, the real crisis could be years down the line. We talked to Hurley Medical Center pediatrician Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha and Associate Dean at the MSU College of Human Medicine Dr. Dean Senko about an initiative to deal with the long-term impacts of lead exposure in Flint. That's coming up. This weekend, the Lansing Symphony welcomes one of the great violinists on the current scene to the Wharton Center. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with the fiddler Rachel Barton Pine and Maestro Timothy Muffet about this Saturday's concert. Hi, Jamie.
Hey there. Happy Tuesday to you. Cold Tuesday as well.
Thank you.
It was a really great pleasure to talk to Rachel Barton Pine about her selection for this weekend's Lansing Symphony Concert, The Scottish Fantasy by Max Bruch, a work she clearly adores. However, Maestro Timothy Muffet also has plenty to say about the other two works on the concert, Dvorak's Eighth Symphony, as well as the King Lear Overture by Berlioz, which, get this, ready, came to his mind while he was on his way to Paris to assassinate his ex-fiancée and her mother.
Those were the days.
I know, right? It does sound like a soap opera, but no, it's a true story from the real life of Hector Berlioz.
Right, right. It's real life, and it's funny how sometimes when I read about that specific anecdote, it's just almost tossed in there as an afterthought that, oh, yes, he wrote this while he was on his way to assassinate his fiancée, you know, as if he was stopping to have lunch or something. And Berlioz, we hear this in his music, was just a very unusual individual in many ways, clearly, and idiosyncratic both as a composer and musician and as a human being. And so any story involving Berlioz is going to have some level of human interest. Fortunately, he gave up on his plans to follow through with that task and came back to writing this piece of music.
Joining the Berlioz King Lear Overture on this weekend's Lansing Symphony Concert is another romantic work, the Eighth Symphony of Antonin Dvorak.
You know, this program is a real feast of romanticism, and it's kind of looking at three very different facets of the romantic era in music. There's a great connection between all these composers, and in this symphony, I almost feel like in looking at all of his symphonies, this is the one where he really found his own voice in the symphonic genre. When we hear, for example, the Sixth Symphony, it's just so strongly aligned with the music of Brahms. It's still brilliant and beautiful and has that great Furiant in it, so it's still Dvorak. But you feel that strong shadow of Brahms. And in the Seventh Symphony, we feel the strong influence of Wagner. And then in the New World Symphony was a whole, that's just a completely different thing, really, in looking at the symphonic output of Dvorak. And so here we have the Eight, which to me is where everything really came together. And Dvorak's Bohemian roots speak clearly in this piece, but not to the point where that's what it's about. There's a certain purity of expression in this piece that I think is one of the reasons it's so appealing.
The center of Saturday's Lansing Symphony Concert, being led by Maestro Timothy Muffett, is a selection performed by one of the great violinists of the upcoming generation, the Chicago native Rachel Barton Pine.
Rachel is one of those musicians that I've been following for years and years, and she's had an extraordinary career. She's someone that's been, you know, on our wish list here with the Lansing Symphony for quite some time, and so we're just very excited that the stars aligned and we could get her signed up.
As for the piece Rachel Barton Pine will be playing, well, it's an odd amalgam of late Romantic era Europe and was written by a German, dedicated to a Spanish violinist, and has the title of Scottish Fantasy. So how exactly would Scotland enter into this work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the Brooks Scottish Fantasy is such a wonderful example of music being a universal language and bringing cultures together. In fact, Max Bruch, the German composer, loved Scott's tunes, claims to have collected over 800 of them, though he didn't finally visit Scotland until subsequent to his composition of this great masterpiece. The Spanish violinist, Pablo de Sarasate, actually spent a great deal of his time touring in the British Isles as well as all around Europe. And he visited Scotland quite frequently. Not only visited Scotland, but clearly absorbed the music that was in the air, the folk music and fiddle music. Sarasate himself actually composed a medley of jigs and reels and struths, stays and things for violin and orchestra, much earthier than Brooks' sort of elevated art music treatment in his Scottish Fantasy. And so the fact that Brooke wrote this piece for him, Brooke would have known that he was writing for a violinist who knew the Scottish fiddle style in his ear. And having done Scottish fiddling myself for more than a decade, when I play this concerto, I sort of allow myself to bring the inflections and the ornaments and all the sort of Gaelicisms, as you might call it, to the interpretation so that it's not sort of square how you might interpret the rhythms that you see on the page in a more Germanic style, but that you give it a little bit of lilt, you give it some little snap.
The instrument Rachel Barton Pine will snap with, performing with the Lansing Symphony this weekend, is certainly a historic one. It's a Guarneri violin, created in 1742 with a very specific name.
Exposini ex soldat, as it's called. Each of these instruments of that renown has a name attached to it, which is usually a former owner or player. And in this case, Marie Soldat was a protege of Brahms, who actually selected the instrument for her. So it's amazing to play an instrument whose voice the great Brahms selected, and an instrument that was associated with a powerful woman player from the past. But it's really particularly cool because Guarneri was also the maker of Paganini's violin, and Paganini's violin also hails from that same year, 1742. So it's just a real powerhouse of an instrument, and just a gorgeous fiddle that allows me to do everything I could possibly imagine and even inspires me to come up with things that I might not have even thought of.
As a child performer herself, Rachel Barton Pine greatly believes in the need to support talented at-risk youth and has established her own foundation to seek out and aid the talented musicians of the next generation.
We don't select or discriminate against young artists based on national origin, ethnicity, race, gender, etc. We basically select the best players who have the dream of building a life in music and who are also very financially challenged. You know, we've supported more than 70 young artists at this point, as well as our international program, which brings basic instruments and supplies to countries in Africa and the Caribbean, et cetera. We've worked with young people in Haiti most recently, and we're working, of course, on our curriculum of music by composers of African descent from through the centuries and around the world to bring that neglected and wonderful repertoire to students of all races and ethnicities, and, of course, to particularly inspire minority students who might not realize that they have such an important part of classical music history as part of their heritage. You know, people don't realize that there were all black orchestras in America in the 19th century, kind of the equivalent of the Negro baseball leagues. People don't realize that Booker T. Washington and Frederick Douglass were enthusiastic amateur violinists. There are so many untold stories that really are very important in terms of, you know, helping students feel like, you know, they're not playing somebody else's music, but this is their music too, because that's really where our future lies, is to get as many talented youth from all walks of life involved in classical as we possibly can, because they each bring their own unique voice to it.
Rachel Barton Pine, guest violinist with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra and Maestro Timothy Moffett for this Saturday's all-romantic concert at the Wharton Center. You can find tickets and more information at lansingsymphony.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Oh, there is some energy. Coming up on Current State, more energy. The Detroit Auto Show is now open to the public, and Cobo Center is a much different place with the completion of a huge renovation project. Current State Scott Pohl talks with General Manager Tom Connors about how Cobo's become more attractive for convention business in the Motor City. That and more after the break. Current State, three times every weekday, twice on 90.5 FM, once on AM 870 WKAR. This week's staff music pick features a young Minneapolis-based singer, songwriter, and producer who's generating attention. At the age of 22, John Mark Nelson has already released four full-length albums. His most recent, I'm Not Afraid, came out in September. It includes a moody but nervously energetic track that I like. It's called Control.
I could try to let you go, even learn to do without. I could give an answer to my doubt. Never even call your name, never even turn around. I could stay away and keep you out.
John Mark Nelson's impressed listeners with insightful lyrics and well-crafted, some say meticulous, arrangements. He's caught the attention of NPR, which has featured another of his tracks on its Heavy Rotation sampler of songs that it can't stop playing. John Mark Nelson is scheduled to perform at May's Sasquatch Music Festival in Washington State. Again, his latest is called I'm Not Afraid. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us. Governor Rick Snyder takes the stage for his State of the State address tonight. The issue that will dominate the evening is the state's role in the Flint water crisis. The head of the Michigan DEQ has already resigned, and some Flint residents are calling on Snyder to do the same. But while the political fallout might be taking center stage now, the health consequences of lead exposure in Flint will last much longer than the next election cycle. A new partnership between the MSU College of Human Medicine and Hurley Children's Hospital wants to address those long-term impacts on the city's children. Joining us to talk about the Pediatric Public Health Initiative is Hurley pediatrician Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha and Associate Dean at the MSU College of Human Medicine, Dr. Dean Cinco. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Atisha, you've been a key figure in bringing attention to this crisis in Flint. Your analysis of the lead levels in Flint children's blood is one of the reasons the state finally took action. What made you want to do those tests in the first place?
Right. So in late summer, we were hearing about elevated levels of water lead, so lead in the water. And when pediatricians hear about lead anywhere, we get alarmed. There is no safe level of lead in a child. So we wanted to see if that lead in the water was getting into the bodies of children.
You went to the state with the data, but then the state came back and questioned your data. What was that like?
Well, it was kind of unnerving. So, yeah, there was a good week and a half of 2 weeks of them disputing our data, saying that we were wrong, that, you know, their data was not consistent with our data. But after a while, with some good conversations, they re-looked at their data and actually admitted that my findings were consistent with their findings.
Well, now that the states acknowledge the mistakes that were made by the DEQ and other departments, we're at a point where a lot of people are asking, what next? Dr. Senko,
right.
MSU's College of Human Medicine is going to be partnering with Hurley to figure out how to move forward on this. Dr. Senko, tell us a little bit about the goals of this new pediatric public health initiative.
Well, actually, this initiative is being led by Dr. Mona Hanna-Atisha. So you have the lead person on the line with us today. But she has some wonderful ideas on things that we can do.
Why don't we pass it off to you, Dr.
Right. So this pediatric public health initiative is just a reinvestment in Flint. MSU and Hurley have been part of the Flint community for over 100 years, and this is our recommitment to the future of Flint. So the goals of this initiative are to continue to assess what happened, so continuing the research to see how bad was this exposure. The second goal is to continue the monitoring of these children. This is a long-term problem, and these kids need long-term neurodevelopmental follow-up. And the last part of this initiative is the intervention. So we can sit back and in 20 years see the consequences of this population-wide exposure, but we can't. We have an opportunity to build this model public health program with experts from MSU and experts from Hurley to intervene so that we do not see these devastating lifelong consequences of lead poisoning.
A question for either of you who wants to take it. Are there events in the past, incidents in the past, that point the way as to how this may unfold, or is this unique enough that we don't really know how this will unfold?
Yeah, I think this is a unique experience. The closest that comes to it is what happened in Washington, D.C. about 10-15 years ago, where they also had an alteration of the water chemistry in the municipal water supply, and it led to increased levels of lead in the water. However, it doesn't appear that Washington, D.C., in follow-up, did anything nearly as comprehensive as what we're proposing here. So I think this is a unique opportunity, and we will be providing some unique data for everyone to analyze.
We want to offer our listeners the opportunity to ask questions of our guests as well. Feel free to tweet us at KAR Current State or email us currentstate@wkar.org. Dr. Hanna-Atisha, explain for us here just briefly, again, some of the major areas of concern when it comes to kids who've been exposed to lead. What kind of impact can that have on a child's development?
Right. So the two areas that we worry about the most are the impact on cognition and behavior. So lead exposure actually drops your IQ. So imagine what we've done to this entire population. We've shifted our IQ curve potentially down. And then lead also impacts your behavior. So it causes attention deficit, hyperactivity, control issues, and it's even been linked to criminality. So it causes these problems that impact education, it impacts employment, and it really affects people for their whole lives. And that's why we're not supposed to have any lead anywhere and that there's really no safe level in a child.
Do we know how many kids were exposed to lead in Flint's drinking water?
Right. So we are assuming that every child, everybody who drank or cooked with this water, cooking actually concentrates lead in your food. And unfortunately, we had 3 boil advisories in the onset of this water switch because of high levels of bacteria. So anybody who
are you're saying that actually made the problem worse?
Absolutely, yeah. We had high levels of E. coli in the very beginning, and people were told to boil their water. And boiling, which most people think is you know, makes water safer, actually concentrates lead in anything that you're cooking. So anybody who drank or cooked with this water was at risk. And our research and state numbers really underestimate that risk because we screen for children routinely for lead at the ages of 1 and 2 years of age. That's because developmentally they have hand-to-mouth behavior. They're crawling, they're exposed to lead paint or lead soil, and they're putting it in their mouth. But lead in water affects a very different and even more developmentally vulnerable population. It affects fetuses, so in utero, and it also affects babies on formula. So imagine that formula-fed baby who's just getting tap water mixed with powdered formula. And their lead levels could have peaked at 3 months or 4 months or 5 months. And because of the short half-life of lead, we don't really pick it up when we're screening them at 1 year or 2 years. So we're really under the assumption that all of our children have been exposed and thus really all need these secondary prevention interventions. So we do not see the full impact of this exposure.
Dr. Dean Senko, the research component of this initiative is going to be focused on kids because they're the population that's most vulnerable to the damage. Can you talk to us about some of the specific questions that you want to investigate?
Well, I think we have multiple areas that we're looking at, as Dr. Hannah Atisha discussed, looking long-term at the neurodevelopmental consequences. So, for example, we have on our team developmental psychologists, faculty who are skilled in developmental assessments. And they'll be helping us generate ideas on how we can monitor these children over time to see what changes, if any, from what we would expect are occurring in the population. We also have perinatal experts. We have pediatrician experts, medical geographers, and others who will be exploring any number of questions. So, for example, Dr. Hannah Atisha just mentioned the most vulnerable, perhaps, are the youngest of infants. So one thing that has been proposed is to look at cord bloods and see what the level of lead is or was in the cord bloods of women who gave birth over the past 2 years in Flint and compare that to a control community.
Dr. Atisha, when would you expect the impacts of lead exposure to start showing symptoms?
Right, that's a great question. So the issue of lead poisoning is not a today issue. There is a time lag. So most research shows that about in 3 to 5 years is when you have the presentation of these symptoms. And that is when children start needing those executive function skills. That's when they start going to school and having to, you know, use different higher level skills. And that's usually when it presents themselves. So usually early school age is when we may see these symptoms. But we are hoping that with this initiative and with some of the interventions that we hope to introduce, that we don't see the full consequences and many of those impacts.
Are you suggesting then that if a child doesn't demonstrate any worrisome symptoms in less than 5 years, do the odds go way up that you could probably give that child a clean bill of health beyond
it's
5 years?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to tell. It's very difficult to tell. And even when that kid, say in 7 years, gets diagnosed with ADHD, we will never be able to say this was from lead or was this kid always supposed to have ADHD. So that kind of contributes to this parental guilt and anxiety because they will never know the full consequences of this exposure.
What I know there are measures that can be taken to mitigate damage. Talk to us about those, please.
Sure. So we kind of see these as in three big buckets. So nutrition, education, and health. So nutrition can play a huge role in mitigating the exposure. Specifically, diets high in iron, calcium, vitamin C can help promote the excretion and limit the absorption of lead. So we're trying to promote that diet. MSU and Hurley already came up with a recipe set. And every week at our downtown Flint Farmers Market, we're actually demonstrating one of these healthy recipes. But we need better nutrition access in Flint. We actually have no grocery stores in Flint. So we're working with our nutrition experts, MSU Extension, to promote.
There is no soup. I'm sorry. I have to interrupt there. There are no supermarkets in the city of Flint?
No, there are no supermarkets in the city of Flint. So Flint has pretty much every obstacle to a child's success. There are no grocery stores. We have a 40% poverty rate. We have high rates of unemployment, high rates of violence. Our children had every obstacle ahead of them, and then now they have lead poisoning.
Dr. Sanko, on Saturday, President Obama declared a federal emergency in Flint. This frees up around $5 million in federal aid to help the state distribute filters and water and testing kits. To fix the water infrastructure that led to the problem, Governor Snyder says the state will need $55 million in addition to $41 million to pay for water distribution and filters. Adequate funding is clearly going to be an essential component of dealing with the effects of this. Where will funding for the Pediatric Public Health Initiative come from?
Well, I think we're looking at multiple sources. I've heard the governor, for example, talk about trying to get a supplemental from the legislature to address this issue. So we're hoping that state and perhaps some federal sources, we've been talking with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, hopefully they will come forward and help to support some of these research initiatives because they are complex. They are going to require a lot of human and other resources to conduct, and it is going to be something that we're going to be doing for many years to come.
Dr. Hanna, teacher, one real quick question in just the few seconds mm-hmm. we have left. Should a family mm-hmm. in Flint using a filter worry mm-hmm. today about the water coming out of its taps?
No, if they're using a filter that removes, if it's a NSF lead clearing filter, it is safe.
We want to thank both of our guests. Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha is a pediatrician at Hurley Children's Hospital in Flint. We've been talking about the Pediatric Public Health Initiative, a partnership between Hurley and MSU to study and mitigate the effects of lead exposure in Flint kids. We've also been joined by Associate Dean for Prevention and Public Health at Michigan State University's College of Human Medicine, Dr. Dean Sanko. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck. And this segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The North American International Auto Show in Detroit is open to the public through Sunday at the Cobos Center. Since last year's auto show, a $279 million multi-year refurbishing project has wrapped up at the Motor City's most important convention facility. Scott Pohl is back from his annual trip to the auto show with more on what's new at Cobo. So what is new, Scott?
Well, Mark, first of all, President Obama is expected to tour the auto show tomorrow, so you might say that the refurbishing of Cobo Center is wrapping up just in time.
I guess.
The work on the interior of Cobo has been complete for a while now, with sprucing up the exterior being the focus over the last year or so. General Manager Tom Connors tells me that the installation of the second of two massive video boards outside give Cobo a Times Square feel.
If you go to Cobo Center today, you will see a 160 by 30 foot video screen in the front of the building that's serving as our marquee. It will not only identify the building and show promotional videos of the surrounding areas, things to do while you're in Detroit, but of course it promotes the events that are here and are upcoming.
I saw it as I approached the building up Jefferson, and it's unmissable, unmistakable, and I would say a nice job has been done with it.
Well, we have a nearly 60-year-old building, which we spent $279 million renovating over the past 3 years, and that's now complete. But this is a new signature look for the building, and it really updates it and also provides a glass curtain wall and a porte-cochere at the front for cover drop-off. And other elements inside the building, we've tried to create a sense of place, our Detroit shop, and we've added a new coffee/wine bar, which reflects the changing culture in downtown Detroit, and also features Great Lakes Roasters, who are a local company that have similar establishments here in the Midtown area, which is one of the great growing areas of downtown Detroit.
All right, $279 million over several years. Was it on time? Was it on budget?
Both, in fact, and a tremendous job. This goes back to the establishment of the Detroit Regional Convention Facilities Authority by the state of Michigan. Took the facility over from the city of Detroit as a bit of a precursor to the emergency financial manager being put in place. The city was running a deficit of almost $20 million, and that has all but been erased now in our annual operating projections. We're ahead of the state's expectations, and it looks the pipeline is full in terms of bookings. We've tripled revenue, increased to over 400 event days a year, and that has been greatly assisted by our marketing partners at the Detroit Metro Convention and Visitors Bureau. As I said, the Detroit Regional Convention Facilities Authority put this expansion and renovation together in short order. They've only been in existence for 6 years, and within the first year began the design and preparation and actual construction of what became a five-year and now very successful update and renovation of the space.
Explain 400 event days, because even in a leap year, there's only 366 right. days. How does that work?
We're doing a lot of simultaneous events, and those are both large and small, and the addition of our new 40,000 square foot ballroom, which is housed in part of what used to be the old Cobo Arena, has really added to the flexibility of the facility. This summer, we brought in American Society of Association Executives. It's a convention for people that put on conventions, and the response to Detroit and Cobo Center was overwhelming. This is a place we want to be in the future. Leads that we've gotten and requests for proposals from some of these groups have been coming in constantly since, and so that will continue to pay back the investment that the state has made in really making Cobo again a leading facility in the region and, in fact, the world. The building was originally opened in 1961. It was the largest convention center in America at that time. Renovated in 1989, and kind of a cool thing, every sitting president since Eisenhower, who was here the day it opened for the auto show in 1961 at their annual dinner at that time, every sitting president has come to Cobo, and President Obama's visit makes it complete up to date.
How long is the Detroit Auto Dealers Association commitment to Cobo for the North American International Auto Show in place now? How far in advance do we know it will be here?
We are in the midst of a five-year, multi-year contract, the first one that was ever done, which was for 3 years ago. And we're in discussions now which indicate that they will be here for the foreseeable future. They were very instrumental, the Detroit Auto Dealers, in lobbying the state to do something about Cobo in order to keep the show here and keep the show competitive with New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, and to make it a truly international show. And if you go down on the floor today, you will see the most spectacular exhibits that are not just the best of any American or North American auto show, but of any trade show in America. People talk about the Consumer Electronics Show out in Vegas. It's a big show, but the amount of construction and design work, ingenuity, and production aspects that go into the displays here far and above anything that gets done anywhere else in the U.S.
I'd like to ask you about transportation around this part of Detroit and how important it is to how Cobo functions for its visitors. The People Mover, the upcoming light rail going up and down Woodward. What is your perception of the ease with which your visitors can get around Detroit these days?
Well, right now, as the downtown becomes busier and busier and parking becomes in higher demand, the People Mover has become all the more integral. You should pick a spot where you want to have lunch or dinner if you're coming to Cobo, park there, and then get on the People Mover and come into Cobo at the People Mover station that's right here on our fourth level. I think that's the easiest way to get around. The M1 rail is only going to enhance that, because that will give you a north-south access to all of downtown, midtown, and right up to the north part of the city.
We're talking with Cobo Center General Manager Tom Connors. And with the Detroit Red Wings preparing to move away from Joe Louis Arena to a new facility, do you have any concern about what might be left behind? I expect there might be a big empty building right next door to Cobo. How much do you know about what might become of the Joe Louis Arena after the Red Wings move?
Sure, and this is a very important question in terms of the future of Cobo Center. As part of the city's bankruptcy proceedings, one of the creditors was given the rights to develop that space, and with the requirement that they would demolish it immediately and begin building something. One of the requirements was to either consider or commit to building a five-star hotel, which could certainly be complementary. In the meantime, there have been the beginning of conversations between the DRCFA and those people that have the development rights, and we hope to see the ability in the future to be able to talk about extending what Cobo does over in that direction.
Well, if this big multi-year project to renovate Cobo Center is complete, what's a guy like you got left to do in the next year or two, Tom?
One of the great things about Detroit, maybe its greatest asset, is its people. And similarly, the greatest asset here at Kobo is our people. And we've got this great, young, professional staff who are going to continue to successfully operate this center on into the future, whether I'm here or not.
Tom Connors is General Manager of Kobo Center in Detroit. Thank you.
Oh, pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
We'll also point out that Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint spoke with reporters today in Germany on a conference call about the Amir Hakmati case, as well as developments in the Flint water crisis. WKAR listened in on that. Governor Snyder is expected to address Flint tonight in the State of the State address. Of course, Kildee says that while he doesn't expect the governor to devote all of the $500 million state budget surplus to the Flint crisis, he does hope to see some sort of financial commitment to the city.
It's going to be a number that would be a substantial portion of that that will be required to make it right in Flint, and I sure hope that he plans on a very substantial commitment to our community.
Congressman Kildee says he will return to the U.S. tomorrow. He expects Amir Hakmati and his family to return a few days after that. That's our program for today. Tomorrow on Current State, tonight's State of the State address will be the most scrutinized of Governor Rick Snyder's tenure because of the Flint water crisis. Tomorrow, we'll hear responses to it from House Democratic Leader Tim Grimmel and Republican State Rep Tom Barrett of Potterville, who represents the state's 71st district. Also, according to the census survey taken in 2012, 20% of adults in the greater Lansing area are functionally illiterate. Capital Area Literacy Coalition is a nonprofit working to change that number. On Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with Executive Director Dr. Lois Bader and volunteer Dr. John Lesk about the organization. Glad you could join us today. Don't forget, we're a podcast. Get Current State delivered straight to your smartphone every morning. Just subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get fine podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.